Hi, everybody. We have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and today our guest is Gregory Nava, writer, director, producer, film...
Fanatic.
former film teacher. A former film student, graduated from UCLA.
If it has the word film, that's I think that speeds it up.
I'm there. If it's film, I'm there. Absolutely.
Welcome, Greg.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here and an honor, Leonard. I'm a huge fan, and it's great to talk to you.
Well, we have a little history together. Exactly 40 years ago, I can't believe this because we both look so young. But exactly 40 years ago, my wife and I attended the Telluride Film Festival in Colorado, as we just did over Labor Day weekend again. And we were still living in New York City, and we saw an amazing film in its debut screening called El Norte, your film. We were on the verge, we were just about to move to Los Angeles, but being Manhattanites, we had never dealt with or thought about immigration from Central America, the culture shock of poor or uneducated people coming to modern day LA and dealing with such technology as washer and dryer, things like that. That's one of our favorite scenes in the film. It just opened a giant window for us. And as we were adjusting to life in LA, we just kept thinking of your movie. And I've never stopped doing
and
so.
And to this day, it is referenced rather frequently because of that.
Yes, I mean, it's so overwhelming. That was the first film that I made coming out of UCLA. I was young, I was full of fire, you know, I wanted to have the story told about my people. I'm from the border, and so I've seen the situation my whole life, and I really wanted to get that film on the screen, and I was so overwhelmed that the reception at Telluride was so fantastic, and of course, it changed my life as a filmmaker, and, you know, the film went on to be nominated for the Academy Award and shown all over the world and was tremendously successful. But the thing that I'm most proud about that film is that it had such an impact. It was theatrically released, as you know, and you know it played at the Music Hall in Beverly Hills for a year. It was a very, very popular film, and it had such an impact on this country that there was a movement with the immigration community, and we worked with a lot of these immigration groups, and it was instrumental in getting the United States government to actually change its laws and to grant protective status to the Mayan refugees from Guatemala and from other parts of Central America, and actually saved thousands of lives. And that is the thing I'm most proud about that film, and actually my, you know, my whole career, because we made the movie with no money. I mean, we had a crew of five people in a Volkswagen van, and we're down in the Mayan highlands and in Central Mexico and in Los Angeles. I mean, all the locations that you see in the film are real places, you know, it was very, very powerful. And to make a film with five people that changes the laws of the United States, to me, just shows, you know, how impactful film can be, and also how the fire and passion of filmmakers can really make a difference.
Mm. Well, part of what was so exciting was that we knew this was your breakout. Mm-hmm. This was your moment. And we were sharing it with you. We in the audience were sharing it with you. We were experiencing it vicariously. And the audience, I think it was in the Opera House, was cheering, and we were cheering with them. And it was a, what we now call a Telluride moment.
Mm-hmm.
something that you don't forget. You don't easily forget.
You know, well, I'm a great believer in the universality of the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel that if you tell the story of your village, you tell the story of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what we tried to do with, you know, with El Norte. And, you know, we succeeded in doing it. And I really strongly believe in that. You know, this year's Telluride, I was talking to you earlier, Leonard, about showing the masterpiece by Satyajit Ray, The Music Room, from 1958. And here's Satyajit Ray. I mean, his films, the Oprah Trilogy and The Music Room and all of these great Days and Nights in the Forest and all these great films, they're about, you know, village life in Bengal. I mean, that really inspired me. One of the films that inspired me to do El Norte was the Oprah Trilogy, because you go, I related to that little boy in Bengal. And I'm not Bengali. I don't speak Bengali. I'm not from a Bengali village. And yet Satyajit Ray had the ability to transcend and make a universal statement out of that film. And that was very inspirational to me. Another film that was very inspirational to me to make El Norte was Los Olvidados, the great film by Luis Buñuel about poverty in Mexico City. It's so touching and so moving and so powerful. And I realized as a young man going to see these films for the first time that, again, if you tell the story of your village, you tell the story of the world. And that's what I decided I wanted to do as a filmmaker.
Well, my dad says this all the time. The more specific something is, somehow the more universal it becomes.
That is absolutely true, you know, because people would make these films and go, well, you know, let's make it general, just from some Latin American country, you know, San Marino or something, you know?
Yeah.
And that doesn't work.
No.
You know, El Norte is very specific with the Mayan huipiles and they're speaking in Quiche and everything. And that's true, because the more specific you are, that's brilliant, the more universal it becomes, because everybody's culture is specific and people immediately identify and relate to that when they see films.
My husband says it doesn't matter what language it is, you can always tell when someone's husband is in trouble. And it is so true, because again, it's that there are things that are universal. You may not understand the language, but you can look at two people and go, oh shit.
And, you know, it's funny, but I was reminded of something when I saw The Music Room, because I actually met Satyajit Ray. He came to UCLA and I sat down and had an opportunity to sit down and speak to him. And he told me something that really stuck with me, that was a real lesson in great cinema. And he said, all of the nodal moments in your film should happen in silence.
Hmm.
Or they should, if your movie's going to be any good. And, you know, when you see The Music Room, it's such a textbook in every great moment in that movie with Chubby Biswas is in silence by the expression on his face, you know, like Bela Balazs talked about the close-up being the silent soliloquy of cinema. And that is really, really true, because the minute you do not put words to it and you let people feel the emotion, it becomes more universal and more powerful.
Well, it's also, you know, because you are a film lover, you're aware of this. One of the greatest experiences I've ever had was when I was 8 years old and we were at the Cinema Muto in Pordenone, Italy, and I watched Charlie Chaplin in a 2,000 seat theater with people who had the little translation.
Yeah.
And everyone laughed at the same time. And it's one of those things that has stuck with me my entire life, because it was like, wait a minute, it can be funny for everybody. It doesn't have to be English, or it can, you know, you can translate it into God knows how many languages it was being translated into. Though I will say, there was one translator who kept eating potato chips, and there was a few films that we saw, and he was chewing. And again, just things you don't forget as a kid. But when you see movies have that sort of an impact on people, when you experience it for yourself, and obviously this is, I am Selena generation.
Okay.
And that is something, so my dad didn't see it when it came out. And I love that movie. I still love that movie. One of the things that blows my mind is how well it plays to this day, because it's perfect. We were all in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois for Ebertfest.
Mm-hmm.
And Chaz was showing Selena, and I said to my dad, we have to go. We have to go see it in a theater, big screen. I hadn't seen it on a big screen since I was a kid. My dad had never seen it. Going in, I didn't want to ruin anything for him, but I wanted to explain the situation, because having grown up in Los Angeles as I have, that when Selena was killed, and I was raised in part by a Salvadorian woman who is still, mm-hmm. I call her my mamita, she's my bonus parent. When Selena came out and became famous, it was huge, and her music was phenomenal, and she was such a performer, and she was so special. And when she was killed, seeing so many people in my life just completely lose it. And I remember crying. I remember finding out we were all crying. So I'm telling this to my dad before we go to the theater. And I said, you just have to understand the way this affected people. It was mind blowing. And then you add the Jennifer Lopez situation, which was people were pissed because she wasn't Mexican. She's not Mexican. She's Puerto Rican. And this is where obviously I have about 1,000 questions for you. You knew, you saw, and you knew she is perfect.
Perfect.
She's perfect.
That, I mean, so I was blessed as a filmmaker to have Jennifer Lopez, the perfect person at the perfect age to do this part. And so much of what gives the film the impact that it has is her incredible performance. All the things that we've been talking about, the universality of the human experience, mm-hmm. and all of these things played into the way that I made Selena, mm-hmm. because so many people were saying, well, this is a TV movie, and you know, she's just this Mexican American, and you know, it's like less than stuff. And I'm going, no, you know, Selena can and does have a light that is so powerful and overwhelming, and the way she overcame all of these barriers, you know, in her life, mm-hmm. was so impressive and so inspiring to young women, Latinas especially, but to all young women, and then to everybody.
Anyone.
So when I was offered the part, the film to do, a lot of people were advising me to not make it, because they're saying, mm-hmm. well, this is a pot boiler, it's a TV movie, and you're an important filmmaker, and you shouldn't do this film. So I was walking, at the time I lived in Venice, California, and I was taking a walk thinking, should I accept this or not? And I met these two young girls. One was 8 years old and one was 10 years old. And they were walking. They were Mexican. And they had Selena t-shirts. So I stopped them and I said, why do you love Selena? And they looked up at me and they said, because she looks like us.
Mm-hmm.
And that just touched my heart, because I realized that our young people don't ever see themselves in the screen. Our young girls don't have a princess.
Especially then,
especially at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, Selena has become the princess, and the movie is more popular today than mm-hmm. we made it. It's unbelievable. It's become like the Bible, the canon. You know, it's the most popular film in our community. People love that film, and it's always a shock to me.
I know.
You know, just how much, you know, impact that film was had when it had its 20th anniversary screening at Cinespa. There were 6,000 people there, sold out. Everybody dressed like Selena. Mm-hmm. And those little girls were now grown up, and they had little girls who were all dressed like Selena.
Right.
I was there with Eddie Olmos. We hadn't seen the film since it first came out. We were shocked at the impact. I mean, people had memorized the dialogue.
I'm one of them.
Yeah, they recited, that's tough to be a Mexican-American, word for word, you know, they had that with the movie, singing along with the songs, and Eddie and I looked at each other, and we could not believe it. You know, a film takes on a life of its own once it goes out into the world. You know, you do your best work, and then, boom, you know, you see what happens. So what's happened to that film is really extraordinary. But I do have to say that so much of the power and impact of the film, credit goes to Jennifer Lopez. Her performance is without question one of the greatest in the history of musical biopics. You know, she had to be a multiple talented performer in order to do this, because not only do you have all these dramatic scenes, so she had to be a phenomenal actress at such a young age, but also the dancing was so
important.
So her performance as a dancer. And of course, what Jennifer did was she danced like an actress. She didn't dance like Selena. She studied Selena's videos and worked with Pete Estudillo, who was Selena's dance partner, and she mimicked Selena's dancing. So when you see them side by side, you see Jennifer is dancing like Selena. And then from a teenager to a fully mature performer, she also traced her dancing to mirror the evolution of Selena's dancing. Yeah. I mean, it was brilliant beyond words. It is Selena's voice in the movie.
Right.
Because you can't replicate that voice.
No.
Her voice was extraordinary. She had an unbelievable instrument. But Jennifer's lip syncing was so perfect that I remember Dave Grusin, who did the music for the film, looked at me and said, you know, we had that shot of her, you know, singing in the recording studio like this.
Yeah.
He goes, you look at me and you tell me that's not her singing. I've never seen anything like that. And I said, that is Selena's voice. Selena had a very low register, which is what gave her voice such power. She normally, when women sing with men, they move the woman's voice up an octave. Not Selena. She sang in the same register as the men. And it was a powerful, powerful instrument. But more than that, she had a light that was so special that allowed her, you know, I often talk to, you know, like the myth of Parsifal, this young guy who gets the Holy Grail when nobody else can get it, because he just doesn't see the obstacles. He just walks through. And all the other knights are so crazed with all the problems that they can't do it. So she moved through these barriers, these obstacles. And people said to me, you know, it wasn't just the crossover into English language albums. The first crossover that Selena made was in the Tejano music world, which was dominated by men. And she was the first woman to become a star in the Tejano music world, and she became its greatest star to this day of all time. Then, as a Mexican American, going to Mexico, where they don't accept us, you know, she then conquered Mexico, and they love her more than anybody in Mexico. You know what I mean? I mean, to this day, at every wedding, they have these special Selena songs that they sing. And then finally, crossing over to the mainstream of United States pop culture. So here's this 23, you know, she was killed when she was 23. She had done all these crossovers in her life. That takes a special person with a special light. And when we made the film, everybody put their egos away and we all dedicated ourselves to channeling Selena's light and trying, you know, it was a tragedy what happened to her, but we wanted to do something that could give her light to the world and keep it alive, because it was so important.
But this is
what's
so great.
And I think for everybody.
Watching it with my dad, having him see it for the first time, for the performance as well as just Selena. You know, at the end he goes, Jennifer Lopez is phenomenal. And I said, imagine you're watching that for the first time. It's a knockout. And then as I say, because it was also made so close to when she passed, which is not common at all.
Yes.
To have something made that quickly. So that, you know, in some of your final scenes, when you have the people with the candles holding up the pictures, it was such a raw nerve. And it allowed, I think it was cathartic for a lot of people to celebrate her in that way, but then also to cry with all of these other people and just feel heartbroken. But that was such, we don't have that experience ever.
I was blessed in a way, because the studio wanted to release the movie on the second anniversary of her death. So this was released 2 years after she passed.
Yeah.
And I think it's the only musical biopic that was ever done so quickly.
Yeah, it, I think
So
you did.
when I did the interviews with the father and with Chris Pérez and with all of her friends and everything, everything that we were depicting in the movie, the memories were really fresh.
It just happened. Yeah.
Yeah. It had just happened. So I got this information like no filmmaker has ever gotten, you know, about right. all of these, you know, incredible scenes. And I remember when I was interviewing, you know, Chris Pérez, he said, well, do you want me to tell you what really happened? Or do you want me to tell you what Abraham, you know, her father wants you to know? And I said, you tell me what really happened. And she goes, well, you know, the thing was that it was really Selena's idea to elope, not mine. Mm-hmm. The father always thought it was Chris corrupting his beautiful daughter, you know? And then he proceeded to tell me the scene, which is almost verbatim what is in the movie about the, you know, about the bridesmaids and this and that and, you know, all this stuff. And he's just going ahead and I go, oh God, this is amazing dialogue. I mean, this is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
So they did that scene in the movie. Well, when Abraham read the script, he hit the ceiling and went nuts because he goes, you can't do this. I said, well, this is what really happened. And this is when he found out that Selena wanted to elope.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you can't do this. You can't make a movie for our young girls that say it's all right to disobey her father. And I said, yeah, but it's what really happened. And don't you, we spoke for hours. And I finally talked him into it saying, look, don't you think it's good for our young women to find their own independence? I mean, wasn't she a very strong-minded? Yeah, well, that's true. Selena was like that. And her independent. Yes, that's true. Selena was like that. And isn't that what all children have to do? Find their own way, find their own voice, find their own path and become independent of their parents and their own thing. He goes, well, that's true. And so finally I talked him into it because so much of the movie is about a young woman finding her own self yeah. and her own true self, which is what Selena did. And so finally, Abraham looks at me and goes, well, if I have to look bad to make Selena look good, I'll do it.
Wow.
And so we got the script done the way I wanted.
Oh, my. Now, the Achilles heel in most musical biopics is that the person or the actor or actress playing the leading role can't possibly match the charisma or the talent or the, you know, the excitement of the original. I'm thinking right now, I'm not trying to take pot shots, but I'm thinking of Renee Zellweger playing Judy Garland.
Well, that was
several years ago.
That was
and,
silly.
You know, there was only one Judy Garland. Mm-hmm. And right. they made a choice, the filmmakers made a choice not to use Judy's voice, but to have Renee Zellweger sing her songs. And for me, the movie just died right on the spot, died right there. Even though the film is not about her performing, it's about her tumult, the tumult of her life at the very end of her life. You can't present this woman as Judy Garland because
it's
she
not
doesn't,
Judy Garland.
It's not, and she doesn't begin to approach what Judy sounded like or the incredible force that Judy Garland was, which is everything you dodged
yeah.
in Selena. And,
but that's part of why the fact that Jennifer Lopez is, the fact that she does sing is so important because it meant that she understood how certain things have to look. Mm-hmm. You know, you have, I mean, to some degree, she has to be singing even when she's lip syncing. Otherwise it doesn't look real, you know?
Well, yeah, just the breathing. You just, yeah. just how you breathe. It's just
you
not moving your lips. There's a whole physicality
yeah.
to the singing that Jennifer understood and captured perfectly. And I, you know, I do agree with you, Leonard, 100%. The voice like Judy Garland or Selena, that is their soul.
That it's, mm-hmm. yeah,
and when you hear their voice, it's a mirror to their soul. And I agree with you that, you know, with Judy Garland, you don't hear Judy. I mean, he's so distinctive, so
you
powerful.
You can't yeah. pretend to
it
be
just
Judy
is not,
Garland.
It's just not the same.
No.
But I will say about speaking about Jennifer and her music career, when we went in to make Selena, she did not have any ambition to have a musical career.
Yeah.
Was making Selena that gave her that. And it was specifically the Houston Astrodome's sequence where she performed. And here I you know, have to say another element, you know, because I think that when you make a movie, you are it's not one person makes a movie, you know. I understand the auteur theory, but by the token, it's a family that makes a movie, and there's a karma and a you know, a whole, the location can affect it, and all sure. these things can affect whether or not how the film turns out. In our case, I insisted that we shoot in Texas because I knew that we would have the support of the Tejano community who loves 100%. Selena. I had no idea the level of support that we would get because we didn't have a lot of money to make the movie. So when we're doing the Houston Astrodome scene, okay, you know, we want to fill the stadium. We decided we're going to do it in a stadium, but we didn't have any money for extras. So we put an ad in the paper and said, come Sunday, help us shoot the scene for Selena. You know, we were at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio. Bring your families. Come dressed as you would come to a Selena concert. We didn't know if anybody would show up. 35,000 people showed up.
Oh my God.
They stayed all day. There is no CGI in that opening scene. Those are all real people really filling that stadium. And that's the kind of love that people had for Selena and the kind of support that they wow. gave me and all of us in making the film. And when Jennifer went out and she had rehearsed and got all the moves and everything, and she started to do this performance, and the people went insane, it filled her in a way that she had never experienced before.
No.
And after we finished that scene, we were both like crying because it was so emotional. And she looked up at me and she said, I want this. I want this in my life. And the very next day, she talked to her manager, and that's what started her off on her mm-hmm. musical career.
Well, easy to believe and easy to picture being energized.
Oh, that scene. As I say, Greg, when I tell you that I know this movie scene for scene for scene, I genuinely do. The other day, someone walked by me in a shirt that says anything for Salinas, and I about lost my mind. I was laughing so hard.
Yeah, but that's become like so famous.
Anything it's so Salinas. Famous.
Yeah, I know.
So funny. It's like, so famous.
It's surprising to me, and you see it on coffee cups and hats, and I mean the whole thing, you know, and everybody's saying that, you know, anything for Salinas. And every time I do an interview now, because I still do a lot of interviews about the movie,
of course,
on Spanish, you know, media and stuff, I always end up with anything for Salinas, and everybody goes nuts.
Well, because as again, this is why the fact that it was made so close to when she passed, you had everything was still so fresh emotionally for people that. When you say this, when you say, you know, I asked if anybody wanted to come, yes, they filled in. It was something they could do for her. It was yeah. a way they could repay the way she made them feel, and they could take part in something so special. And those scenes are mind blowing when she's in the carriage going around. I mean, all of that, you feel the energy. And this is what is how, you know, I was raised by older film lovers, is that it's my country for practical effects. I don't think anything, unfortunately, I don't think CG, whether it's CG fights or CG characters, I just don't think anything can match what we can really do. And so when you have those scenes of her on those stages, when you have all those people there, you feel that energy, you feel something. And it's part of, as I said, it's part of why people still watch the movie and have a reaction to it, because everything feels so current and alive.
Well, and the Tejano community filling that stadium up, and then you were talking about the scene with the candles, and 5,000 people showed up for that. There's no
sky
there either. I mean, it was, you know, and so much of what gives the film the beauty and the power that it has comes from Jennifer's performance, of course, but also the Tejano community supporting us in that way. I remember that at Jennifer's first wedding, marriage, shortly after the movie, and Oliver Stone was there. And I was talking to Oliver Stone, and he was saying, wow, he's going like, how many extras did you have? I said, we had 35,000 extras. And I said, and we didn't pay one. He looks at me and he goes, for the Doors, the most I got was 10,000, and I had to pay them all.
That's very funny.
So funny.
Let's just wind back a little bit. Tell me what happened after the screening of El Norte in Telluride. What happened?
Wait, I want to go back further than that first.
Yeah.
Where exactly did you grow up?
Okay, I am a border guy. Mm-hmm. My family, I was born in San Diego, but really I was raised in San Diego and Tijuana.
Right.
I have a lot of family in Tijuana to this day. We used to cross the border all the time when I was a kid. And, you know, so I'm bicultural and bilingual, and I come from that very specific world, which is a very unique and different kind of world. And it is the only place in the world where the first and third world meet.
Mm-hmm.
And on one side, you have this squeaky clean Republican city of San Diego, you know, and on the other side, you have all this poverty and cardboard cities of Latin America. And of course, you know, Tijuana, that poverty, and this is one of the things that I wanted to get at with El Norte, is a poverty of being uprooted. People are coming to cross the border. If you go back to their home, it's very different. And that's why I really wanted to do the village scenes in El Norte to see the world they come from, because the poverty in the Mayan Highlands is very different from what they experience when they reach Tijuana. The border is part of a process. I always say El Norte was born in the middle and grew in two directions. And it very much comes from a child, like a six-year-old child, who crosses this border. And you don't understand the politics and the history and the sociology. Yeah. You just see this contrast. And a child wonders why. And I wanted to capture that in the film. I didn't want to get involved. And you don't hear any statistics. You don't hear any politics.
Yeah, yeah,
you don't hear
yeah.
any of that stuff in the movie.
No.
Because I wanted to keep that point of view that I had as a child seeing this. And I think that that's one of the things that made the film so successful. And really, you would have to be from the border in order to have that perspective, because most of the films that have been made about immigration and situation, you know, are looking at it from a sociological or a political
right.
perspective.
Right.
And El Norte does not do that. I also have to say that I was blessed also with El Norte, with the two leads, Zaida Silvia Gutierrez and David Villalpando, who played Rosa and Enrique. They were both like 20 years old when we made that movie, and they were beautiful performances, and people fell in love with Rosa and Enrique. And you really learn that if you're going to have a successful movie that's going to touch people's heart, you've got to find the right person in the lead.
Yes.
Just like with Selena, you know,
yes.
and Zaida as Rosa. I mean, what a performance. I'm thinking of her because she just, I was just celebrating with her birthday yesterday and sending her a greeting. And she's such a great actress. And her performance in that movie was so beautiful. So, you know, they did a big restoration of the film at the Academy, and it premiered in Europe at the Berlin Film Festival. This was just before the pandemic. I didn't know if anybody would come. And it was like, the Germans are great. And that festival's great in terms of audience participation. It was like 900 people filled this theater. I looked at the theater and thought, you're showing El Norte here? Who's going to come to see, you know, this 35-year-old, you know, a movie about Mayans, right? No, they filled the theater. We got a tremendous standing ovation. Zaida and David were there. They came up, and it was a very beautiful, very, very beautiful experience. And also, the refugee situation now in Europe is so strong.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
All of
sure.
these issues that were in El Norte suddenly now are in Europe.
Yeah.
And the
yeah.
Germans, when we did the question and answer, they were saying, my God, this is just like what's happening here.
Sure.
And they also said, this doesn't seem like a movie that's over 30 years old. It seems like it was made last year.
Well,
that's the film that, you know, is, as Sandra Schulberg said, is evergreen. And Selena is the same way. You know, these are films that, even though they're old, they don't seem old. And I'm very pleased with that, because I feel like, you know, again, it gets back to this point about telling the story of your village and the universality of the human experience. And if you can touch those things,
yeah,
then I think that you can have a film that, you know, that lives long. And that's what you want. I mean, you really want, you know, and you see these great films like Satya Ajit Ray, or even, you know, like you're talking about Chaplin, or these great films from the past, you know, there are certain ones that really still resonate to this day. And that, you know, they have they have, I think, what Orson Welles referred to as diamond body. And that's something that I've always tried to achieve with my film, is to give them diamond body.
When did you fall in love with film?
It doesn't always work, but when it does, it's great.
I mean, it's a solid track record. When did you fall in love with film? At what age did you fall in love with film in general?
Okay, well, that's a good question. My family was a film-going family, you know. So, you know, my parents, they both fought in World War II. And you know, coming out of the war, having a family was the most important thing to them. And we used to go to the movies all the time, to drive-ins, you know, when we were little kids, you know, because you could make noise. And those are the days when you used to go to drive-ins. Mm-hmm. And also to big theaters, and you'd go to the theaters. And so when I was a little boy, you know, the lights would go down, it would be dark, and these images would suddenly come up on the screen, right? It was like a dream, okay? And it was like, whoa. And I just said, you know, Peter Pan and, you know, all these films that I used to love, you know, Knights in Armor films and the Vikings and all of these things. And I just used to sit there and I just, amazing. So we once went down to see the Ten Commandments, you know, the Sissel B. DeMille epic. And we all went down, the whole family, but my grandmother and everybody got down. You know, it's like going to mass, you know, going to church, you know, go through the Ten Commandments, Moses and all this. So we all go down and we're sitting there. And I don't know if you remember or if you know, but in the original version of the Ten Commandments, it didn't start with credits or music or anything. The curtain opens and there's a shot of a curtain. All right. And this guy walks out from the curtain to a microphone, and it's Sissel B. DeMille. And he's talking to the audience about the movie that they're about to see. And it's about, you know, freedom as opposed to, you know, a dictatorship of Pharaoh and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And that you were going to go to the Holy Land with this movie, and that they drew on all these sources to tell the story of Moses. And it was going to be, you know, 3.5 hours long. And we hope that you enjoy it. And then he disappears behind the curtain, and suddenly da 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 da, you know, the stereo track comes on, boom boom, you know, and up come the credits. And I'm sitting there and I'm going like, wait a minute, this guy made this movie. You know, to me they were just dreams before, then suddenly somebody did this. Right. And then you're watching the movie and there's like Pharaoh's chariots and the Red Sea opening and all of this, and I thought, that's what I want to do.
Yes, please. I'll take
I want to do what he does, you know? So ever since I was little, I've always wanted to, you know, to be a filmmaker. And I remember that when I was sitting there and we were preparing to shoot the Houston Astrodome scene in Salina, and I'm looking up and I see 35,000 people filling this stadium. I said, I made it, CB.
You sure did. You sure did.
But that's why I wanted to be a filmmaker. And I'll tell you that when I told my parents, because, you know, we were a poor family and my brother and I were the first people in our family to be able to go to college. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know,
I first went
to Berkeley and then I transferred to UCLA to go to the film school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my brother, who is a very talented artist, by the way, you know, he was not a great student, but he was a fantastic artist. Right. But I was like this straight A student, you know, and real, you know, won all kinds of awards for mm-hmm. academic awards and all these things, you know? And so my family thought, oh, Gregorio, he'll be a doctor or he'll be another, he'll be a lawyer or doctor. And my mother said, he'll be a great lawyer. He can talk the leaves off the trees. You know, he can convince anybody of anything. So when I told my parents I wanted to be a filmmaker, you know, you should have seen the looks on their faces. And I wanted to go to film school. But they didn't. They absolutely accepted what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. They never objected. And they said, and they supported me completely to do whatever I wanted. And I remember my mother saying, Greg, I know that you will do great things, whatever you choose to do. I tell that story because I think that that's what parents need to do.
Yeah.
Parents should support the dreams of their children. And my parents supported my dream. And I'm eternally grateful to them for that.
Well, that's number one. on the list of things to do in life, choose good parents.
Yes.
I had good parents who supported me and encouraged me.
Yeah. And
my parents are nightmares. They are awful to be around. You've met my mother.
I love your mother. She's fantastic.
Everyone loves my mother. She's amazing. But I will tell you, my husband and I say to Daisy, who's now almost two, you can be anything in the world you want to be, Daisy, except an asshole. That's literally all I care about. You can be anything. Just don't be a jerk. That's all I want from you.
Unfortunately, you know, in our businesses, you know, Leonard, there's an inordinate number of jerks.
Correct.
And part of navigating the film industry is finding those people who you can trust and who
are
wonderful and have heart, because you know, it does attract a lot of sharks.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's part of why the way you all feel. I've been lucky to attend Telluride most of my life. The fact that you all sort of found the Telluride family, and we do refer to it as the Telluride family. You know, I think that it puts so many good people in one place, and so many people who just genuinely love movies. I always try to explain, you know how you'll hear from Cannes, this got a 14-minute standing ovation, or people booed this movie, and you go, oh my God. In Telluride, to me, there's no show me attitude.
Yes.
I feel when people sit down in the audience, they really want the movie to be good.
Yes, you know? They're
they
a great audience.
And
I think this is appropriate at this moment to give a shout out to Tom Luddy.
Of course.
Who started the festival, and he was such a great guy. And I first, you know, knew, because I originally went to UC Berkeley, and he had this program there called Cinema Psychedelica, where he would show all these, and that's where I first got introduced to, you know, to Ed M. Schwiller and, you know, all of the great Kenneth Anger and all of those underground films, because he would show them. And then he brought Godard to Berkeley, and he was so fantastic. And then, of course, he started the Telluride Film Festival, and I love Tom, and, you know, he knew about my student work. And then when we were doing El Norte, because originally El Norte was for PBS, it was going to be on TV. And I got a call, and it was Tom Luddy. And he goes, I want to come and see your movie. I said, whoa, Tom Luddy wants to come see my film. I can't believe it, you know, but he knew to do that. I mean, no one would know to do that. I was nobody, zero. Right. But he did that, and he came and he saw the movie, and then he selected it for Telluride. And as you know, it was a tremendous success there. And that's changed my life and the lives of thousands of people who got their status. Well, if Tom Luddy hadn't done that, right, I wouldn't be here talking to you today.
Yeah.
It takes people like Tom Luddy, and so many people in this business, if you aren't a famous filmmaker, you're not a star, or you're not a big deal in Europe, they don't want to talk to you, right? But Tom Luddy wasn't like that. Tom Luddy was somebody who would beat the bushes and go out and find new voices and bring them their filmmaking to the world. And there's so many filmmakers who owe so much to him. And then also, after the success of El Norte, of course, you know, I was trying to do Mi Familia, My Family, which the Academy is now restoring, and which was Jennifer Lopez's first movie, and has Eddie Olmos and Isai Morales. And I mean, all of these incredible actors are in Mi Familia. And I couldn't get it made. Nobody would make that movie. Mm-hmm. I took it to everybody in town, and it was no everywhere. And I thought, what am I going to do? I can't get this thing done. And I thought, I'm going to send the script to Tom Luddy. Maybe he can help me, you know, because he was getting into producing at that time.
Right.
So I sent the script to Tom Luddy, and I didn't hear from him for a month. And then he calls me up and said, I really liked your script. I'm going to give it to Francis to read.
Meaning Francis Coppola.
Francis Ford Coppola, because he was working with Francis Ford Coppola. So he gives it to Francis Ford Coppola. Francis read it immediately. And then he calls me up and says, come on up to Napa Valley.
Jesus.
So I fly up on a Sunday to Napa Valley, and I go to meet him in this fabulous mansion that he has up there. And he says to me, I loved your script. It's really great. And we should, you know, get it made. And I said, okay, but Francis, I have to tell you something. I tell you, everybody said no. I went through all the people, you know, New Line, Warner Brothers, everybody. Nobody wanted to make the movie. So we really don't have any place to take it. And Francis goes, okay, who was the softest no?
Ha!
Wow. I've never heard that.
And I said, well, New Line, because they almost did it, but then they said no. And he goes, okay, coming to San Francisco tomorrow, Monday, to the Zoetrope office. So go into San Francisco to the Zoetrope office. And he goes, all right, I'm going to call Bob Shea, head of New Line. You know, I'm waiting in the outer room. 45 minutes later, Francis comes out and says, okay, it's a go. We're going to do it in New Line. And then we made Mi Familia.
Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable.
Yes. And that was a tremendous success, as you know. And that was nobody, you know, I was the first person to cast Jennifer Lopez. That was her first film, was Mi Familia. And she made a tremendous impact in that film. I remember when she comes on the screen, I was sitting next to Francis. And he goes, who is that? You know? And he used her, then he hired her for Jack.
He used her in Jack. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Robin Williams. That's how she got that part, was he
Which
saw her
is
in Mi Familia.
Such a different, you know, role for her.
Mi Familia was her first role. And they are doing a restoration of that film at the Academy now.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah. But so Tom Luddy looms large in my career. Yeah. And he was a good friend to the end. I remember visiting him at the end. And he was such a great man. And the story that I just told you, you could have 100 people here,
right,
and they'd all tell you the same story. This was a guy who really made a difference,
yeah,
in the history of cinema and, yeah, in the history of independent film in the United States.
Well, that's opening this year, the guide, and seeing them, you know, it's Bill Pence.
Bill and Stella Pence.
Bill and Stella Pence.
And James Card and Bill Everson, William K. Everson.
Stella is alive and well, just to be clear.
Yeah.
But
you know, I think that Julie did a great job.
Yeah.
This year.
It was
it was a good year.
It was just seeing all of those people, knowing what they did,
mm-hmm,
and how much it means. And as I say, the Telluride family that we're all very protective of.
Yes.
You know, it's,
but she had to navigate, you know, difficult waters because of Tom's passing,
sure,
and the strike of the SAG and WGA strikes
of
and everything.
Course.
And
yeah,
she came through with flying colors. It was a great, yeah, festival this year.
Yeah.
But there too, I mean, part of that is that filmmakers want their films there, especially if you've had your film there before, because, mm-hmm, you know the kind of audience you're going to have. You know, you were saying you saw JR's film, Tehachapi, and they weren't going to do a Q&A afterwards, so he went out onto Colorado Avenue and stood there and talked to everybody about it, because that's what happens there, is, mm-hmm,
he held court on the sidwalk.
You
we all
sit and you
stood
do
around
that
and participated.
You know, you have a wonderful photo when Guillermo del Toro said to everybody, if you want to meet me at 7 a.m., you know, we can
in
have
in front of the high school.
In front of the high school, we can have a discussion. And how 30 kids showed up, because who wouldn't? Because when you hear Guillermo talk about film, it's one of the most glorious things in the world. And you know, it's just
that guy. That guy's a raconteur for, I mean,
yes,
he's brilliant.
He's listening to him, but that's it. Filmmakers want their films there. When people ask me about the festival, I would say filmmakers want to be there because it's an audience that really wants to like your movie, that is there to celebrate you.
But they also show, you know, like Victor Marcel Pecado, the Music Room, you know, La Rue, the Avocats, you know, all of these things, which are really important to show, because Tom was really into that, you know, showing,
right,
the films from the past and, you know, keeping those legacies alive. So not only do you see the new films, but you also see old films from the past that, you know, need to be reseen, and
right,
they energize you when you see them. So Telluride is this fantastic balance of different elements in film, and that really reflects Tom's perspective on cinema and the way he saw cinema, and, you know, Bill Pence as well, who was a great guy. I really like Bill as well.
Bill was just sort of a perfect. Tom was quite quiet. Tom didn't he didn't necessarily love spotlight for himself.
No.
You know?
No.
Bill is the one who he loved it. He yes. loved it and he cherished it. He was a big guy and he just sort of, he loved meeting everybody yeah, and being with everyone.
Yeah. And Tom liked introducing people to people.
Yes. Yeah.
That was his big thing, putting people together.
Yeah. Yep.
And he thought that if I put people together, stuff will happen.
Stuff will happen.
Yeah.
And look what happened with Mi Familia. You know, he puts you yeah. together and boom, you know, the movie happens. So he's responsible for a lot of, you know, a lot of filmmakers and films getting made and people getting to know each other and starting on. He was really brilliant.
I was looking at your filmography and looking at the cast list. There probably is not a Latino yeah. actor or actress alive you have not worked with at one time or another.
It's a bit like Harry Potter. If you're British and you weren't in one of the Harry Potters, something's wrong.
Yeah.
Like something's wrong.
But I mean, everyone from, you know, from Rita Moreno to Lupe Ontiveros.
As you say, Isai Morales, who's so talented. I love
Isai. I know. You know, and Lupe was, her favorite film was El Norte and Nacha. I mean, that role, I mean, was stunning. I mean, she's the moral center of that movie. Mm-hmm. And when she says to Enrique, Rosa may be dying, but you're already dead. I mean, that moment and her delivery of that line, it hits you right in the heart. And she loved it because, you know, in these other movies, she's always playing the funny maid. But this was a woman that had tremendous depth as an actress. I'll tell you a Lupe Ontiveros story. One of the last times I saw her is she comes up to me and she starts hitting like this. Boom, 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 boom. She says, I hate you, Nava. I hate you. I said, Lupe, why? What? She goes, you gave me that role to play Yolanda Saldivar and Selena. And everywhere I go, people think I killed Selena. Yeah, I hate you. I hate you. And I said, Lupe, you asked me to give you that part. You begged me for the role because you wanted to do something dark and serious and heavy to show what a great actress you are. And I said, and you are. And I gave you the part and you were begging for it. And she goes, yes, I know. I did beg. She says, yes, I know. I did beg you to give me that part, but I hate you for giving it to me.
And if you don't know who we're talking about, folks, look up Lupe Ontiveros because you've seen her
in everything.
You've seen her so many times.
Goonies, you know, and Jack Nicholson, As Good as It Gets.
But it's true. That's another performance where she's so good in Selena, you just believe. Honestly, you could tell people to a degree that Selena is a documentary, and I don't know they'd argue because so much of it just feels real.
But you know, I want to interject something because the style of my cinema is
Edward James. Almost, it's like.
Yeah, the style of my cinema is dream realism. And when I made El Norte, people said, it's got to be tough and gritty. And I said, no, I'm going to do this like a novel by Garcia Marquez or Miguel Ángel Asturias. The dream realism and poetic realism is so natural to our world, especially since the roots of our world are indigenous, native, and the mythology and these images, the white butterflies and all of these beautiful things. I'm going to bring this to the screen because I thought to tell a Latino story, we have to find our own Latino way of telling a story. Mm-hmm. I don't want to imitate something else. So El Norte is credited with bringing this dream real style that you see in the novels of Marquez to the screen for the first time. And it was very rich and lush. And the same thing is true of Selena. You know, that scene where the two little girls are on the roof looking up at the moon and the whole end sequence, you know, how are we going to do the death of Selena? And that whole end sequence, you know, which I had to give a special seminar with at the Academy once for how we put all that together and did that, is all dream realism. And I think that when you tell a story using those ideas and that style, it's natural to Latino stories and to our culture. And it also reaches this subconscious dream level that people feel. You know, Hitchcock talked about, you know, the acupuncture needles of the images in a film that are like beneficial shocks. And that always stuck with me. And so I always try to bring these images to the screen that are like acupuncture needles to your unconscious and that open up these things that people still talk about, like, what are all those white butterflies? What do they mean in El Norte when her mother is lost, and the fish and the flowers and the moon and Selena and all these images, that dream images that I bring into the cinema, which I think gives the film a depth. So yes, it is real. So you're right, but it's also dream realism. I like to bring the two things together in the films that I make.
Mm-hmm. But that's why I said the reason that Lupe had that reaction is because it felt so real. It felt like she was Yolanda Saldivar who killed Selena. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, I can't even imagine the kind of emotions.
We got help actually from the police, because they weren't supposed to do this, but they snuck to us the tapes.
No.
Of when Yolanda was in the truck with a gun at her head.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And the guy was talking her out of killing herself.
Yeah.
And we heard those tapes.
Oh, my God.
And Lupe heard those tapes. And her scene is exactly what Yolanda really said.
I killed my best friend. I don't deserve to live.
I don't deserve to live. I want my mother.
I want my mother, yeah.
And Lupe goes, I'm going to say that. And I go, I don't know. You know, I want my mother. That's a little tough. Goes, no, I want to do it. And I said, okay, we're going to do it. And it's in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So powerful. She really captured that. So you're right. You want to have that reality. But the whole way it's done with all of the, it's like a nightmare, fragmented.
Yeah.
You know, like one of those films that I saw at Cinema Psychedelica, you know, Dog Star Man, you know, with all this change in framing and textures and stuff. And
I also think
you really get to a deep level with that I think that really made the end of the film. You know, one of the problems that I had with that was I didn't want to do the scene where actually Yolanda killed Selena, because I said, I do not want to spill Selena's blood for those young girls that I met in Venice. How am I going to do this?
Yeah.
And again, we get into the dream realism because I was thinking about ancient Greek drama.
Hmm.
You know, in ancient Greek drama, Oedipus Rex and the Oresteia and all of these things, they're violent. You know, you kill your mother in the bathtub with an axe. I mean, you know, it's like, or rip your eyeballs out. I mean, it's like heavy stuff. But you never see it on stage. What you see is the consequences of the violence.
Yes.
The results, yes.
Yeah, and I went, that's it. You know, and that's the problem with violence in movies, I think,
yes.
Is that we see the violence, but we don't see the consequences of the violence.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I'm not going to show the violence, but I'm going to show the consequences of the violence.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's dreaming about singing in English, and then the white rose comes, and then all of a sudden, the first person that you see how it affects her is Yolanda,
mm-hmm.
and how it destroys her. Then the next consequences of the violence you see is the family weeping,
oh, God.
Weeping in the hospital and
crying in the hall,
crying
and Chris is
and then
on the
finally,
floor. And
then finally, the fans and how it affected the fans. And so what we showed, the way we did the sequence, was to show the consequences of this violent act as opposed to the violent act.
I also think, though, that it is, I think one of the biggest problems that we have with films today in a general sense is sometimes you don't treat your audience the way you should treat your audience. Your audience is, at least hopefully, smart. They don't need to see everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like we say, you know, in horror films, what we imagine is so much worse than what anybody can show us.
Sure.
And you know what I mean? What I can create in my head is so much worse. And so that's, again, there's a moment we didn't need to see Selena get shot. We don't need to see her fighting with Yolanda, getting shot, being carried away on a straight, you know, you don't need to see all of that. It's not necessary. Most of us who've watched the film know what happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even if you don't, you immediately figure it out. She's in the ambulance. You see her ring fall onto the
well, and you hear the radio, and you hear the radio and television announcers saying what happened.
You know what everything is.
So you get it, but
you don't have to see that horrible moment.
Yeah,
none of us need the visual.
And I think that, you know, I have a big thing about violence in movies, And it does get back to this point, is we do not see the consequences of the violence. And that is essential, I think, to showing violence. And again, we have a problem with all these games that are very violent and you just people mowing people down. So, you know, we're entering into a culture that sees violence with no, that has no consequence. And I think that's damaging.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But as I say, it also just, you don't want to be the one who puts that image into the world.
Yeah.
None of us saw it. None of us need to see it. We mm-hmm. know what happened. Yeah. You know, we can all, knowing is hard enough mm-hmm. without seeing.
Well, mm-hmm. I wish more filmmakers took that approach.
Yeah.
And maybe if we keep talking it up,
yeah,
we'll inspire somebody to use their imagination and let the audience use their smarts and their imagination.
Because you don't even, when the family finds out daddy and you don't, you don't hear them speaking, you don't hear them crying.
You don't need to.
The song is playing. You just watch them all fall apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's so painful.
Yeah.
And it breaks your heart. Again, it's why I know the movie so well, because it stuck with me as a kid. But then whenever it's on, it's one of those that I have to watch. You know, you say it to me all the time with your, when my parents have TCM on, which is most of the time, you know, oh, such and such came on. Now I can't do anything else. I have to sit there. Selena's one for me again, because it, emotionally, it was something that I was so aware of. You sort of feel like watching it helps keep her alive.
Yes.
And speaking of TCM,
it keeps your light in the world, which mm-hmm. I think is a very beautiful thing. And that's what we tried to do. That's what we did it. Ourselves to doing when we made the film. But what I feel was, and I really believe this, that somehow or other her spirit did come through us. Mm-hmm. And I believe in that. You know, when I write on my writing desk, I have this artifact, an imitation, you know, of an artifact that was found in Tikal, ancient Tikal, the Mayan city. And it's a bone, a hollow bone. And on the bone is inscribed the creator gods who were, you know, like in a canoe because they were sailing across the Milky Way and planting stars to create the universe. The creator gods, paddler gods. And it's a hollow bone. And what it's saying is that when you create, you are a hollow bone and something flows through you. You know, so I think that that's what you need to do when you're making a film and you're telling a story. You have to put your ego away and let the story flow through you.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that that was the spirit that everybody had when we made Selena. And I feel that her spirit did flow through us and reach the screen. And that's why the film turned out to be as strong and as popular and as powerful as it was. And still is. As I said today, it's more popular than when we made it.
Mm.
Now, we go to Turner Classic Movies all the time in this household, and your El Norte, which we've been recalling and praising to the skies because it deserves all of that, is going to be on TCM, right?
Yes, it's going to be on October 5th on TCM. And it was funny because they didn't tell me, and I found out from someone who worked with TCM on the bus at Telluride. He goes, "Hey, you know that's going to be," I said, "October 5th, you know, 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock in New York, which would be 5 o'clock in Los Angeles. They're going to be showing it, and I'm going to be very interested to see what their introduction is going to be like. But they're doing it, of course, in conjunction with Hispanic Heritage Month, and I'm very proud of that.
October is Hispanic Heritage Month.
That's
it's
great.
Going to be on TCM. Which I love. And I love, I love Jacqueline Stewart. You know, I work very closely with the museum.
Sure.
And, you know, she's head of the museum. And so, I'm a big fan of hers.
Well, we're big fans of yours, mm-hmm. if you mm-hmm. couldn't tell that already. And we thank you for taking some time out today to talk to us, Greg.
Well, listen, it's a real pleasure and an honor to be here. You know, Leonard, you're a great voice for film and for classic film. And you know, you've been carrying the torch for so long and done such a marvelous job. So, you know, the whole film world thanks you for your wonderful contribution to this great art form of ours. You're an extraordinary person and I really, really, really respect and admire you.
Well, aw shucks. all I can say to
he's
that.
He's not good with compliments. That's very,
but
very
I really value you saying that, Greg. Thank you
yes,
so much.
And Jesse, I've met you. And you, I can feel the torch being passed, baby.
Hey, man.
It's there.
We're doing what we can do, right? You know?
Yeah. Burning oh, brightly. Well, good. Once
thank
again,
friend.
Thank you. And until we meet again.
Yes.
Well, that's awfully kind of him.
Yeah. I know it's hard for you. I know you don't like compliments, but it's a nice thing to hear. And it's true.
We actually served together for a while on the National Film Registry Board.
Yeah.
He's passionate, as you can tell.
Yes.
Passionate about film and passionate about life.
Yeah. It's exciting when you get to share movies with other people, right? That's one of the things that we all enjoy, I think, is showing someone something that you love. And that's why I do say that Selena moment for us, because I've never had that with you before where I went, oh, I watched this movie and now you're going to get to see it on a big screen and I'm going to tell you why it means so much to me, but you get to have the experience too.
Yeah.
It was special. It was unique for us.
Yeah.
For all the movies we watched, it was unique for
us
to get to
do
that. And I'm so glad we did. And I'm so glad that it hit you the way that it did.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
It doesn't require explaining.
No.
With that film.
No.
And it is funny because you and mommy really do quote El Norte all the damn time.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah. Man, movies are great. Thank you guys, as always, for joining us. We're so grateful to you. You can follow me and this guy at Leonard Maltin, at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. You're also on Facebook. We do live streams on YouTube. You can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff. And of course, there is the Maltrion Patreon, which is patreon.com/maltinonmovies, which helps us keep this show going. And again, in gratitude, thank you to everyone.
Yes, thank
who
you
helps.
For everybody who has contributed and continues to contribute to keep our little enterprise chugging away.
That's us. And chug, chug.
Chug, chug. And we will see you next week. Thanks, everybody.